Okay. Tracy Boyd said a little bit before we got started that she thought the lesson that was really short. And I did too until I actually started looking through Bob's book at the beginning point and end point and realized there's a lot more there than the 30-something verses listed on the outline. How many in here are teaching this next quarter? Okay, anybody that wants one of these can have these. This is something that Freddie did. And basically it just lists where the lessons taken this time's outline and where the classes begin. I think there was, let me just throw a couple down. And if more people want them, just tell. Yes. And that is in Bob's book. Now, and that's just the title of the beginning of every lesson. So you go to where you get that subheading. And one thing I will warn, a lot of the agendas that we have and syllabuses that are laying around actually have page numbers from Bob's books. Well, I will say that that gets kind of confusing about the time Bob has released some new, he's revised some books and the pages have gotten shifted. So I think, you know, Freddie did this and I want to share it with everybody because that does make it a little bit easier because those lessons, you know, the story itself is not going to change. The page number in the system may change a little bit, but the story itself will not change. All right. So as we go and get started tonight, if everybody would, go ahead and turn to Mark. In Mark, the 12th chapter, if you look back in one of the last stories that James talked about in chapter 13 through 17, the Herodians and the Pharisees had come together for what purpose? I think I heard somebody say that. That's right. To find some way to trick Jesus into saying something where they would have a cause. A cause to take him, a cause to seize him, and a cause to put him to death. Well, how did that work out for them? It didn't work very well at all. And one of the things we need to make sure that we're very clear when we're teaching the kids, when somebody's trying to put us on the spot and somebody asks us a question and you know it's a trick question, we tend to stop and think and we think through everything we're going to say and we go, okay, all right, here's how I should answer this. Jesus knew absolute truth like we know our name. So Jesus didn't have to pause and think his way through about what are they trying to get me to say? What are they trying to trick me into? We need to see the power of God in the fact that when Jesus was asked these questions, he just answered. And he just went on with his answer. And there was no way to trick him. Therefore, you know, there's not that hesitance with him as there would be with us. Yes. 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 We may not know their motives. We may not know their thoughts. Now, and I say that not to say anything about us, but just not to, you know, we need to make sure that we don't take what would be human situations that would happen. Ooh, I'm in a tough spot. I better think about this before I speak and try to apply that to Christ. Christ didn't have to stop and think. You're right. He knew exactly what their motives was and what they was going to do. But when he was put on the spot or when he was asked a question, questions that would be hard to us, in each one of these, questions that would be hard to us, when they left, what was the general thing that was said over and over in your reading for tonight at the end of the section? They marveled. They were dumbfounded. They dare not ask any more questions. They were, you know, taken back. So the Sadducees saw this didn't turn out, so they take their turn. Now, there's nothing in here that specifically says they're trying to trick Jesus, but from reading the tone of the question, I think it is very obvious that what they're trying to do is the same thing. So, what is it that the Sadducees are beginning to ask Jesus about? What's the general topic? Resurrection. What's unique about that? They don't believe in it. So, I don't know. I've always pictured this, and I could be wrong, but I've always pictured this question as their stump question. That, you know, when they was discussing with the Pharisees, this would be the question they would ask someone that was when they were debating over the resurrection. And this was, the you know, their stump question that people couldn't answer well. So it was, okay, so we're going to take this one to him. And I don't know if that's the case or not. But once again, we know that he could see into their thoughts and their minds. And Christ knew the reasoning behind the question. But the question was simple. It may not say that they were testing him. I think it is pretty obvious from the tone of their questions that they was. So there was these seven brothers, and the first brother married a wife, took a wife. And he died, and leaving no children. His brother took her as wife and married her in order to raise offspring in the brother's name. Once again, that's straight from the law. That is what should happen. So there's no sin there. The second brother dies, leaves no offspring, and the third brother, and the fourth brother, all the way to the seventh brother, and then also the wife dies. So, now, when they are raised in the resurrection, I like the way they word it. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be? What was Jesus' response? You don't know the law. Are you mistaken, therefore? Are you ignorant of this? Because you do not know the Scripture, nor the power of God. And one of the times I'm always, one of the things I'm impressed with is how many times this is Jesus' answer to a question. Don't you know? Have you not read? Do you not know the Scriptures? Do you not understand as it is written? Yeah. So, time and time again, when Jesus is asked one of these questions, He'll begin with, have you not read? Now, for the scribes and the Pharisees, that would almost be like an insult to injury. They prided themselves on knowing the Scripture, because you do not know the Scripture nor the power of God. In this age in which we live, in which these people lived, there's marriage. Sons marry daughters, and there's marriage, and there's given in marriage. But those who are counted to obtain that age, that is the resurrection from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, nor can they die anymore. So what does that do to their argument that stumps everyone? Well, it kind of falls flat. There is no marriage in after the resurrection. For they are like angels. And what does that mean? They are all equal to angels and are sons of God. That's right. They're spiritual servants. They are spiritual after in this resurrection. And no more of these things that go on in the earthly life, marriage and giving in marriage. Those things do not continue beyond. So there are some things here that, you know, though it was not, you know, things we can learn about life beyond, about the resurrection, though it was not necessarily the intent of that teaching. Now, one of the things, and this is just a point that I find extremely interesting from this, definitely not anything to go into with kids. One of the main tenets of Mormonism in times gone by, the reason they built their plurality of marriages was so that someone could build up a larger kingdom. Because when you die and you go to heaven, all of your wives and all of your children, you're the God of this, you know, you're the God of this planet or this universe, and that's how you populated it, your realm. Of which, and that was the basis for the plurality. So once again, I find it, you know, interesting that, simply put, that after the resurrection, there is no more of the earthly relationships that we know. Everyone is equal to God. But Jesus does not stop there. I mean, playing on this concept of, are you therefore mistaken because you do not know the Scriptures, nor the power of God, He goes one step further and says, we all know the story of Moses and the burning bush. But even Moses showed in the burning bush that the dead are raised. When he called the Lord, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And in Mark, it is actually worded, I am the God of Abraham, I am the God of Isaac, I am the God of Jacob. Or I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. What do you get from the tenses of these verbs? That's right. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were they gone from the earth at the time that was said at the burning bush? Yeah, he's gone from earth. But God is still the God of these individuals. What could they say after that? You know, they knew the Scriptures. They knew that it was exactly what was said. I am the God. So at the end we had three reactions to this. When the multitude heard it, what was the multitude's response? And that's in Matthew's account. So, if you know, this is one of those times that's kind of hard. It's really nice with Bible software. We're not going to have three columns on the screen. I have Matthew here, Mark here, and Luke here. It's kind of harder to do in here. But in Matthew's response, in Matthew's telling of the story, it says the multitude, they were astonished at his teaching. The multitudes didn't come with as much baggage. They didn't come with as much hatred. You know, they were astonished at Jesus' teaching. And I find it interesting that the scribes answered, Teacher, you've spoken well. You know, what else could they say? You've spoken well. And we're going to talk about one of the scribes here in just a moment. And then it was said, but after this, they dare not question him anymore. And this is actually repeated after the next story as well. So this being in Luke, whether, you know, It's almost as if Mark actually tells another story that happens in here before this statement is made. But after that, they dare not question him anymore. So the Pharisees and the Herodians got together and they took their turn. Didn't turn out too well for them. The Sadducees, they take their turn, and it doesn't turn out too well for them. And from there, we run into this scribe. Said when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they began to gather together. Now, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, as we get to going through this, are they friends? You know, are they political friends? No, they're political enemies of one another. It's amazing how, you know, a common purpose can bring them together. This common purpose of trying to do away with this Christ that is causing them so much trouble somewhat brings them together. But the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, and they began to gather together again. And though it's told in the context of the scribe coming, it's almost like that's just a point that's put out there. You know, just a statement that's made, and then we flow into this next story of the scribe that comes to Jesus. Then one of the scribes, and the scribe, I put lawyer or teacher, what was the role of the scribe? What's a copy the law? They were also known to have, you know, they were, you know, we talk about teacher, they were the ones that had the, you know, the understanding, the deeper understanding among, looked at amongst the people of the law. So this scribe, one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, who is the them here that's been reasoning together? Pharisees and the Sadducees. They've been asking Jesus questions. He's been answering. This scribe has been sitting back and listening. He heard them reasoning together, and he perceived that Jesus answered him well, testing him, asking the question, "Teacher, which is the first commandment?" What's Jesus' response? We've heard this before. The first commandment is, "Hear ye, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." And the second's just like it. And what's that? Love your neighbors as yourself. And then what is the thing he said at the end of that? And on these commandments, what? Hang all the law and the prophets. So in these two things, Christ has summarized, you know, the teaching of the other, of the laws and the prophets. And time wouldn't let us, but you can go back to the Ten Commandments and you can truly see the breakdown between, you know, these are the ones, the loving the Lord your God, and how then we're commanded our relationship toward one another here on earth in the ends of them. So with that, I ask the question, this testing here, and I've spent some time on this, and one of the reasons I ask it, this testing here, is this the same testing and tempting that we had in with the previous two groups that come to Jesus? Is this the same evil motives? I ask you to hold on to that question for just a minute. We're going to come back to it at the end of the story. You know, I kind of had somewhere in all the ways in the back of my mind, I'd always thought, yes, it was. Because here you have one group after another group after another group that comes to Jesus, and they're asking these questions in order to trap him. But there seems to be, by the time we get to the end of this story, there's something that tends to make me think a little bit different in this case. So the scribe says to Jesus after this, he answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart," and then the second is like it, "to love your neighbors yourself." The scribe's response has said, "Well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth. There is one God and there is no other but He, and to love Him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all your soul and all your strength, and to love one neighbor is more than all the whole of the burnt offerings and sacrifices." Jesus had gotten there, or God had gotten to the point He hated their sacrifices because of the heart that was behind it. And with that, there's this interesting Jesus statement. Now, when Jesus saw that He had answered wisely, He said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom." Now, the statement that's been made here, I think it was Brent and I that talked about this not too long ago. You can listen to me and say, you could hear me go, "You have said well, teacher." That humble attitude of, "Teacher, you've spoken wisely." And you know by my tone what my thinking is for the most part of what is said. And you can also hear sarcasm in my voice if I say, "You have said well, teacher." And if you see, you can hear the sarcasm in my voice, if that is the case. But from Jesus' response, I tend to think this was more of a legitimate question. and not the same testing and trying of the Lord that the others had. Because in the end, he said, you are not far from the kingdom. And I kind of say that because of something Gary said earlier, and that is, Jesus could see into the heart. He could see into their thoughts and into their minds. And it's almost as if he applies more of an honest answer, an honesty to this. But regardless, whichever way, and then we'll open it up for comments after that, what was the result in the next verse? Yeah, everybody was done with this. Okay, the Pharisees and Sadducees, they've had their shot, and no one else dared ask any questions. And this was very much like the one that was actually stated by Luke before the last section. Comments or questions or statements about where we're at up to this point? Yes. And one of the other things I find extremely interesting about all of these cases is, there was no really testing of Jesus, but what did Jesus turn every one of these cases into? They're a teaching exercise for the multitude that was around. What was the response of the multitude? They were astonished at his teaching. No one else dared to ask any questions. So these things that they meant for harm, Jesus turned, and Jesus used these opportunities to teach those that weren't trying to catch him, the ones who were honestly listening to hear what he had to say. Excellent. I hope everybody could hear what he was saying, what James said there, and that's excellent. That, the question was somewhat of a leading question. That give Jesus the opportunity to go off on a political tangent and get his following, but he didn't. He taught that which was very much consistent with the law before. Okay. And then, after this is said, Jesus poses a question. And I hope that they have learned by this point to cringe. Now I'll ask you a question. That tends to be somewhat of a... they've been throwing the questions at Jesus. They've been trying to trick Jesus, to put him in a place where they had something to charge him with. But we saw at the end of the previous story that the Pharisees had gathered together and they're trying to somewhat regroup after he had answered their questions wisely, and he had quietened the crowd and quietened them, amazed the quiet crowd, and quietened his adversaries. And he turns and he asks, he asked the Pharisees, but he asked them in front of those who are gathered together, and he's still in the temple teaching. And, just back to our timeline, this is still in that area of Tuesday, where he did a lot of great work and a lot of teaching, there in the temple. And he turns and he asks the question, what do you think of the Christ? Whose son is he? Matthew words the question a little bit, how is it that the scribes say, interesting, the previous encounter was with a scribe, that the scribes say that Christ is the son of David. So, what is their response? It would have been the response everyone would have given to this question. Who was the Christ? He was the son of David. And the Pharisees acknowledged that. So then Jesus said, in response, for David said himself, by the Holy Spirit in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Therefore David himself called him Lord. How is he his son? Now, what was the response? The common people heard him gladly, but from those that he questioned, absolute silence. What could someone say to that? But what had he said to them? David himself calls him Lord. He is divine. How then is he his son? And that should be down a little bit. How is it that he was human? Here is this one that David had called Lord, called divine. But yet, he is physically the son of David. How did this happen? Well, without him being divine, that could not have happened. And the Pharisees saw it, that there was no other way for that to happen. And the common people heard him gladly. That is a statement that's said all too often as well. Why did the common people hear him gladly versus the leaders and the scribes and the Pharisees? What was the difference? Why was it they heard him so much more, they were so much more willing to listen? Exactly. And the loss of their position. That's right. Exactly. That's right. And in the future, some will hear, some will not. Even throughout the New Testament, it was more of the common people. The ones that who had monetarily less to lose were the ones that were the quickest to hear. But excellent point. And they had as much, they had said that earlier when they said that, you know, if we don't do something about this, Jesus, Rome is going to come and take our, you know, Rome will come, they'll step in and take our kingdom from us and our place. Exactly. And it, and in their list of priorities, they could not let go of it. And once again, no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day on did anyone dare to question. And you see the tone in Matthew, the 23rd chapter. Matthew gives the most attention to the woes. When Jesus speaks out to the woe to the Pharisees. So if you would, turn over to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23, verse 1. Who's in the audience? The who question that we've talked about earlier this quarter. That's right. He's speaking to his disciples, and he's also speaking to the multitudes who were there with him. And then he goes on in verses 2 and 3. The scribes and the Pharisees, they sit at Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that you observe and do. But do not according to their works, for they say and they do not. Verse 4. For they bind heavy burdens and hard to bear, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. So first, as we'll pick up some speed in just a second, but what is meant by they sit at Moses' seat? That's right. And I find that very interesting. What kind of character, what kind of people is this that he is, what is he accusing them of? They're, what's the word that we've come to? This is the definition of the word hypocrite. You know, they say and they do not. They put all these heavy things on you to do, but they won't touch them themselves. So he's accusing them of being hypocrites. Notice the change in his demeanor, in his approach. Now, you know, he is becoming much more stern in his. But even in this, they sit at the seat of Moses, they're teaching the law. Why would he say, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do? These are horrible people. They're hypocrites. So now why should they do what they're told? What they say? That's right. Yeah, they're teaching the law and you... Exactly. And that was the point that Jesus, that he is making to them. These things they're doing, they sit at Moses' seat. They're teachers of the law. And if what they're teaching you is truth, do it. Do it. Observe. But don't observe their behavior. Don't observe them and do what they do. For they bind heavy burdens that are hard to bear, but they wouldn't touch it with their fingers. They're going to tell you to do it. But they would not begin to touch it with their fingers. All of their works that they do to be seen by men. And what have we heard before? If you're doing these great works to be seen by men, what? Have your reward. I hope you enjoy the popularity, the love, the honor that you get by being put on a pedestal if you're doing these things to be seen by men, because that's all you get. That's it. That's the end of it. And there is a warning and there is a danger in there for us to be aware of as well. They make their phylacteries broad and they enlarge the borders of their garments. Now what are these? What is a phylactery? That's right. Where did it start? You know, Deuteronomy 6. Bind them between, you know, bind them between your eyes, on your hands, on your forehead. So they took that one step further and they began to build these little boxes and they would hang them in different places and they would have certain parts of the law. What had it become? For show. Look at me, look how religious, look how pious I am because I wear, you know, I wear this. They were told the borders of their garment. They were told to have this blue cord, this blue thread in the hem of their garden. It was commanded, but they've enlarged it. They've made it bigger. Look at me. Look at me. Look how religious I am. And you can go back to these passages and look to see the foundation of what they're doing was true. But they had turned it into that of a show. They had turned it completely into a show. They love the best places at the feast. They love the best seats in the synagogues. They love the greetings in the marketplace when someone would go by and say, Rabbi, Rabbi. Once again, that place of honor that, you know, we might call the swelling of the head as they go by to be put up on this pedestal. Look how religious, look how great, look how good you are. And they ask for the best seats. And they loved the meaning, the greetings in the marketplace. And again, we've seen. We have seen as this has gone along that even from times past, if this is what they love, I hope they enjoy it. Because this greeting, this being put on a pedestal, is all that is left for them. And this is what Jesus is saying to them here. So with what's going on, and the fact that they hate Jesus anyway, can you begin to feel the tension is, you know, it's escalating and mounting to the point. Now, before, nothing was going to happen to Jesus because Jesus said it wasn't his time. Now things are building up, and we're building up to that. You know, we're in that last week, and we're building up to where it is about to all to come to pass. Jesus continues, "But you, do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren." What had he been trying to teach his disciples over and over? If you want to be the greatest, you must be what? Servant. If you want to be great, you must first be a servant. Where in there is there room for these titles of honor? Who gets the honor anyway? Christ. There is one teacher. Down here, there is one master. There's one leader. The God, the Christ. And you're all equal. You're all brethren. We're all equal. We're all brethren. There is no room for this title. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for there is one father. Do not be called teacher. And this word teacher, in some translations, is master, some is leader, some is director, some is guide. But don't take on these titles. For there is one teacher who is your teacher, the Christ. Now, is it wrong to say this is a Bible class, that so-and-so is a Bible class teacher? Or so-and-so is a teacher? Or so-and-so is an evangelist? No. You know, we have that in Acts. We have it throughout Acts. We have examples of that. You know, he made some to be apostles, some prophets, some teachers, some evangelists. So, it's not in that. So, what is the problem? If that's not the problem, what is it? The exaltation of that person. Exalting myself and giving myself a title of honor. Albert? Heather. And you look into, you know, even specifically, you look into the Catholic Church, and this is Father of this person, this is Pope, this is... But you look into the denomination. This is Reverend so-and-so. You know, we have to be sure, and we have to be careful when we're talking about ourselves, when we're talking about, you know, what we believe. There is this mentality amongst the world and the religious world out there. We have to be even more careful of this concept. Let's not give ourselves any title, any place of honor that we don't deserve, because there is only one place of honor, and that place of honor rests with Christ. Exactly. Yes. If I look and I say, Brother Richter, and I'm talking about this, you know, you are my brother in Christ, and I'm referring to you that way. But if I do that in placing you on some place of honor, you know, the same words, the same thing, but it goes back, you know, in the heart, that is very much true. And that is with several titles that are out there. Alright. And he goes directly from that into what we've already talked a little bit about. But he who is the greatest among you must first be your what? You want to be great? What? Be a servant. Yeah, that's right. Whoever exalts himself will be what? What is meant by that? Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. He exalts himself on when? Whether it be by title, whether it be by the way he lives his life. He exalts himself now. He better enjoy that because the humbling is coming. But what about the one who would humble himself now? In time will come that exaltation. The one who humbles himself, he will be exalted. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you won't go in yourself. You wouldn't dare go in, but you are trying to keep these other people out as well. You see the tone, the harshness, the power with which Jesus begins to speak. This is, you know, this is powerful. Woe to you. You shut up the kingdom against men. You won't go in, but even beyond that, you're not allowing others to go into the kingdom either. You devour widows' houses for a pretense, and for a pretense you make long prayers. Therefore, you will receive a greater condemnation. You travel land and sea, make one proselyte, which is someone who would convert to Judaism, and you make him what? Well, yeah, twice as much a son of hell as yourself. Dangerous, dangerous woes or condemnations to those that are here. And I can't read this section without thinking of my 9-year-old son. I'm sorry. Because this is what goes on playgrounds. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, whoever say you swear by the temple is nothing, but if you swear by the gold that's on the temple, now that's important. Or, he who swears by the altar, that's nothing, but if you swear by the gift that's on the altar, now then I have to keep my word, and it has to be true. You know, I'm not necessarily talking about my son in particular, but I'm saying this is how kids behave on a playground. You know, if I say this, yeah, it's kind of true. But if I say this, I really have to mean it. In other words, this is the way I can get out of saying exactly what I mean and keeping my word. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? Which is greater, the gift or the altar which sanctifies the gift? Stop trying to find ways to get out of your word, out of what you're saying, out of keeping your promises, your oaths. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. For you tithe mint and anise and cummins, and neglect the weightier matters to the law, which is justice, mercy, and faith. Should they have left those things off, the small details that they were so quick to do? No, they shouldn't have left those off. But they should have kept the weightier matters without leaving these other things undone. And this, there are so many great illustrations in here. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. You know, I'm poor and I've got this strainer to make sure I don't do anything wrong. No impurities get in here. And I caught the gnat in my strainer. But yet in so doing, I turn up the cup and in it I swallow something as large as the camel. Going on with that thought, you cleanse the outside of the cup or the dish, but inside, you're full of extortion. You're full of self-indulgence. And I have to think of my coffee cup. You know, after having gotten a couple of refills, a cup of coffee, I look inside that cup, and it is black, and it is grungy. It might be pretty and white and clean on the outside to look at it this way, but if I turn it down and look, it's black, it's grungy. Much like the tombs. They will take time and they'll whitewash, they'll paint the tombs white. But what's inside those tombs? Dead bones. Christ is saying to these Pharisees, these Sadducees, this is you. This is you. You're clean. You're trying to clean the outside, but on the inside, you're filthy. Okay. And he goes on to say, first clean the inside of the dish or the cup, and the outside will become clean. Just a few more, and hopefully we'll finish on time. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, because you build the tombs for the prophets and monuments to these prophets. And you said, if we would have lived back there in the days of our fathers, we wouldn't have killed the prophets. We wouldn't have stoned the prophets. We wouldn't have killed the prophets like they did. His response, serpent, brood of vipers, how can you escape this condemnation? Therefore, you know, I'm going to send you prophets. I'm going to send you wise men. I'm going to send you scribes. This is futuristic. What are they going to do to them? They're going to kill them. They're going to crucify them. Some you'll scourge in your synagogues and you'll persecute them from city to city. You'll kill them. You'll crucify them. The same thing your fathers did to the prophets, you're going to do to the prophets. You will do the same thing that they did. But even with these harshness of words, he ends the section with, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who killed the prophets and stoned those who were sent to her. How often I wanted to gather you together as hens would gather her chicken under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate, for I say you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Okay, one more small, excellent story to end this with. And that is, as Jesus is sitting outside at this, and he ends this conversation, and it says he sat opposite of the treasury of where they would go by and they would give their offerings. Well, he would go by and he would see these people who had a lot of money. They were rich. They had great possessions. And what were they putting in? Treasury. They were putting in a lot of money. And he looked at that and he said, that's good. But then he saw this one poor woman who walks up and puts in her, you know, these two mites. These two mites, very little monetarily, but what was it to her? It was all she had. It was her livelihood. And he is in there. He contrasts the lovingness of this one person who, even out of her poverty and all the liveliness she had, she gave, versus these who had this abundance and gave out of the abundance. So I did get through the material, and so we'll take the last few minutes and open it up for comments or questions. Sorry I didn't leave a lot of people time to talk tonight. Brent? How much we have or how little we have?
Please God.
Right.
Amen.
Exactly. Yeah, and in that case specifically, he condemns, you know, the people and the attitude of the people who are saying it. But I think that's an excellent point, just like Paul, whether out of pretense or out of true desire, he was happy that the gospel was preached. Other questions or comments? Yes. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent point. All right. Anything else? Excellent. Thank you so much for your time and your attention tonight, guys.